Yeah, I have changed the title a little bit by adding light nuclei and in smaller print even in Carl EFT. So make it smaller and smaller and then that you cannot read it. Yeah, I have to apologize. I mean, this was basically a talk that I gave at for German graduate students at some stage.
You believe you are not educated enough?
No, I think I just, I mean, for the less, I would say the opposite. Especially this probably applies here. Maybe, okay. So the questions that might hopefully be answered during my talk, at least for these German graduate students, was why is CP violation beyond the standard model expected? How can a point particle, for instance, an electron, support an EDM? Well, okay, that's trivial, that you know. Why don't the EDMs of certain molecules don't predict a strong CP violation? That's probably not so trivial. What is the nature scale for a neutron EDM? How large is the EDM window for new physics searches? How can EDM producing sources be discriminated?
That's do you mind using most... a red one if you have it?
Huh?
Do you have a red pointer?
No. I have a green one. Okay.
Thank you.
Does anybody have a red one?
How is the low energy effective field theory, why is low energy effective field theory needed here? Why are deuteron helium EDMs measurements essential or at least important? Maybe essential is probably an overstress. So, I mean, you probably have seen this PDG plot of a history of the universe. You know, the most important point is here. The cosmic microwave background part where, you know, photons freeze out and you can observe back to the Big Bang at this stage, 100,000 years after the Big Bang. And so, well, at the end of inflation that is here, whatever happened before, we would expect that then the number of matter and antimatter should be the same because you have this huge dilation factor of e to the 60, I think. You expect that baryon and anti-baryon matter should be of the same size or vanishing small. And everything that is generated and as matter has to be done dynamically during the evolution of the universe from then, from that point on. And that was basically what Sakharov was involved in. The cosmic microwave background measurements from WMAP and Planck later on gave a number of baryon number density versus photon number density at the CMB point. At that epoch of the order of 10 to minus 9 versus the standard models, both of them, I mean, the cosmological standard model and the standard model of particle predict something in the order of 10 to minus 18 to 10 to minus 20, something like that. So Sakharov gave in 67 free conditions. You need baryon number violation to depart from the initial B equals 0 that you have here. That you have in a standard model. I mean, we are anomalies, we are, of course, at nowadays temperatures. This is astronomically or inverse over astronomically small. But at temperatures of 1 TeV, that anomaly would have worked, the B minus L anomaly. You need C and CP violation to distinguish the B production mechanisms from the corresponding B bar production mechanisms with both helicities.
Sorry, can I make a little comment? Because there is some misconception here. This is about this Yaroskog Hamiltonian. Because I just show you another way to treat it. It's maybe instead of m squared. Okay.
Thank you.
M squared and t squared minus another c squared. You can get logarithm of mt minus m over mc, which is not a big number at all. And actually, it appeared. For example, it appeared in our work. So this is kind of not.
Yeah, it's
a misconception. You always need to differentiate.
Also,
a specific mechanism how you generate CP violation in the standard model. And there is mechanism which contains logarithm in standard mass difference.
True. But the masses must be different.
They must be different, but
because then you would have got rid of a phase.
Not necessarily mass squared mass difference over some large parameter.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I mean, I didn't want to make a strong
make
point.
The
point is that this number differs from that number, whatever. So let me get back to the Sakharov conditions. You need CP violation to distinguish B from the B bar production rate. And you either need CPT violation, that would be enough, or out of formal equilibrium to distinguish the B production from its back reaction. In other words, to escape from the average that B is equal to zero if CPT holds, because in the equilibrium, of course, time is out of the game. So then the CPT in the equilibrium of the CPT conservation would already tell you that that B would be in the average zero in equilibrium. Good. So that where we have. So how is CP violation linked to the electric dipole moment? An EDM, an electric dipole moment is first of all just, I mean, you know, it's a polar vector, involves the charges and the separation between the charges. And the separation vector is a polar vector, therefore the EDM is a polar vector. However, if you go to a subatomic particle with mass and go into its rest frame, you don't have any vectors at its disposal. In the rest frame, the momentum is zero, the free momentum is zero. So the only vector that you have at your disposal is the spin, or the total angular momentum of this particle. And that's an axial vector. And that's the reason why basically electric dipole moments are linked to CP violation. If you write down the Hamiltonian, the magnetic part, coupling of a magnetic moment with a baryon, with a magnetic field is fine because both are axial vectors and both behave in the same way under parity and time reflection invariance. However, the product of this structure, the coefficient d times the spin times the electric field, of course, switches under both under parity and under time reflection. So in general, any non-vanishing electric dipole moment of a non-degenerate in every subatomic particle is, at least in close to the ground state, is non-degenerate. Very high up, there might be degeneracies, but violates P and T. And assuming that CPT holds, then CP is violated as well, if T is violated. And we have flavor diagonal CP violation. So in this way, subatomic EDMs can be a rear window back to the CP violation in the early universe. They don't have to, but they can. I mean, there's nothing that tells you, I mean, because you need CP violation in the, for baryogenesis, you must find a hadronic EDM. So this is a rather loose link. They're strongly suppressed, as I will explain in the standard model, in the CKM matrix mechanism. In the order of 10 to minus 31 electron centimeters for the neutron, for the electron even 7 orders of magnitude smaller. The current bounds, here I've written 2 numbers, a direct measurement from 2006. That's basically still the status, 10 years old, with ultra-cold neutrons. It's 10 to minus 26 electron centimeter. Nowadays, you have very strong bounds for mercury. It's in the order of 10 to minus 29 electron centimeters. And with the help of theory input, you can deduce then, I mean, also Victor had done earlier works on that. You can deduce a bound for the proton and a bound for the neutron that is, at least if you trust this, even smaller than the direct measurement. For the electron, you get a bound from a measurement from polar for your monoxide. Polar means that the two atoms in the molecule must be different, either in mass or charge or in both. If I would translate it, this number is not the measured number, but translated, it would be that number. And from that number, you get this rather strong bound. However, you have to compare it with a standard model bound. So, I mean, you are even further away from a standard model bound than for a neutron. So, let me put it together in a theorem that I don't know, this theorem might be much older. I learned it from Werner Bernreuther in 2012, and I started to think about this. A permanent EDM of a non-self-conjugate particle with spin different from zero. So you compare this matrix element with the EDM operator, the matrix element with the angular momentum operator, and you have here a proportional factor D. This is here the EDM operator, and this state is a stationary state with definite parity, non-zero spin, such that these two matrix elements act under spatial reflection and time reflection this way indicated. So the EDM matrix element switches sign under parity but keeps its sign under time reflection. The angular momentum does the opposite. So if this proportional constant is non-zero and this state has no degeneracy besides its standard rotational degeneracy, right? I mean, you could have different magnetic quantum numbers, then P and T must be broken. So non-self-conjugate particle, okay, I've not explained it. It's not its own antiparticle, at least one charge. It doesn't need to be the electric charge, for instance. Strangeness charge must be different from zero. So, and you might say, well, you can even write it more generally because this theorem is a special case of a folklore theorem. I don't know who has first written it down, but it's used at least in lattice QCD quite a lot. Any finite quantum system without explicit symmetry breaking cannot have a spontaneously broken ground state.
Andreas?
Yeah?
If this first matrix element is non-zero, then this state cannot have definite parity anymore. Then you have to get an X mixture of...
No, I'm saying you escape from this equation if D is zero. That's the point. Because we behave differently under parity, and the EDM operator changes the sign under parity. It keeps therefore this J, and J, of course, it doesn't matter what the J is doing. The important thing, this sign switch is coming from the operator itself.
Okay, maybe confused.
But in a way, you can get that same result without ever talking about matrix elements.
Yeah. Well, but this is probably what you do in the measurement. I mean, you really look at matrix elements, not at as an operator.
Well, what I want to say, this first matrix element must be zero.
No, it cannot be, no.
If this state J, P has a definite parity, because then you can replace D by pi parity minus times.
Well,
pi.
You can no. No, I mean because I mean only this linkage here. You can calculate this matrix. I mean, if you want to make this linkage, then it's fine.
Okay, maybe.
Because you don't know the right hand side. It would be zero anyhow. Okay, if D is equal to zero.
Just considering the mathematics without the equation.
Well, if you have P and T broken, you can have this matrix element to be non-zero. Otherwise, you wouldn't. You could stop your work.
But then you don't have a particle which has a definite parity. We have to get a mixture of two parity states.
Well, you have a tiny admixture. You have parity doesn't make sense in this.
Okay. So then this is not a state of.
But it is not you know, it's not. We are talking not about 50% breaking of parity.
Yeah, no, okay. Yes.
But this discussion is why it's kind of better to think about the dipole moment. It's just the dipole projection of the charge operator.
Yeah.
So the symmetries are the charge off, right? We have to have both pairing in time reversal.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So let independent of whether it's one, two, n body, whatever.
Yeah.
Right there.
So let me get to this special version, second version of the theorem. You know, this is done to, for instance, to introduce Kyle symmetry breaking on the lattice. You have to introduce a finite quark mass, and only then you can expect a finite quark condensate. And then it's depending on the, you first take the, would take the lattice to infinity, and then you can remove the quark mass. You should also think in the similar terms here. All these subatomic particles are finite systems per se. Finite means, I mean, finite in extent and then also finite in the walls. And therefore, you are back in principle to quantum mechanics with a symmetric double wave potential. That's what you should think of. And of course, in this symmetric double wave potential, you have, if the wells are finite, you have instantons that can move you from one part of a symmetric double wave to the other one. And these instantons will guarantee for you a level splitting between the symmetrized ground state and the first excited states. So you will have non-degeneracy there. And that means, of course, you cannot measure an EDM without explicit symmetry breaking, that means P or T, or without artificial fine-tuned degeneracy. So this state, JP, can be an elementary particle, quarks, charged leptons, W, bosons, Dirac neutrinos, not Majorana. Majorana escaped because self-conjugate. So of course, the question here arises, that's for students, not for you, but this is, or young students, is an elementary particle, a point particle without structure. How can such a particle be polarized and support an EDM? Well, of course, you know the answer is there are always vacuum polarizations with rich short distance structure. This is the reason why also the magnetic moment is not given by its Dirac part, but by something more. Good. So, but it could be also composite, like a neutron, proton, nucleus, atom, molecule, even a solid state. So then the next question appears, what about the huge EDMs of water or ammoniac molecules? Right, I mean, they are measured, where you can look at a table, they are in the order of Bohr magnitude, Bohr radius times the charge. So the answer is the ground state of these molecules at room temperatures, or where we do our experiments, are so that they are mixtures of at least two opposite parity states, because the temperature is so large that, you know, you cannot decide whether you're in the ground state or in the first excited state, or you have small your applied electric fields are already big enough to overcome this difference. In both cases, you basically have an explicit symmetry breaking, such that this theorem that I mentioned where it doesn't apply, or is naively satisfied.
But in stationary rotational state, the upper moment is zero. The same for the torium.
No, but you have a spin. You have a spin.
Yeah,
you have the spin is enough.
Electric dipole moment of torium actorium oxide in stationary rotational state.
Yeah. Yeah, that is zero. That is zero because the idea is, I mean, if you have a polar molecule, water and ammoniac are not polar molecules. If you have a polar molecule, you have here one particle here, one particle here. The EDM should point in this axis, the quantization is this axis, right? I mean, for the spin, and so they are orthogonal on each other.
No, but see, it's a theorem. You see, it's very easy to test it. In the rotation, stationary rotational states, dipole moment of energetic molecule is zero.
Yeah, but
by external field, yeah. Or by some other.
But if you have, for instance, this water molecule, you have then these two fluctuations of this.
No, but still, dipole moment is zero.
The dipole moment is zero because of this theorem, I mean.
In the rotational state.
But it doesn't transform in the proper way. If you look at the Hamiltonian, then even though this is linear in the external field, it's quadratic in the Simon field. So it doesn't reverse sine.
Yeah, but that's the point. It's of course, well, I mean, first of all, you if you go to very low temperatures or switch off
that's
all electric field, then you are back to the ground state.
So then you get a quadratic Stark effect if you have zero
but
temperature.
When you have, first of all, nothing. When you switch off the electric field, then you get the Stark effect induced EDM. Okay. And if this is big enough, then you have, when you, if the electric field is big enough, then it, of course you will move up the degeneracy. And you will then have something that smells like a permanent EDM, but it's a fake. It's all the time an induced EDM. But you go to the linear Stark effect. So once more, here it is. So where are the questions? Yeah. So basically, for water and free molecules, the theorem does not apply because you have a mixture of at least two opposite parity states. And therefore, you do not need T nor P violation to measure something. So that is what you were pointing out as the induced EDM polarization. And what's about that one? And the induced EDM is, of course, you know, where we have an electric field. The electric field breaks the symmetry. So you escape the theorem of finiteness because the electric field, of course, gives you a direction. And you can put the EDM on, project on this direction. So no problem, you don't need P or T violation. And as mentioned, the water molecule, you are first in this regime of the quadratic Stark effect. And if the E field gets stronger, then you get the degeneracy between ground and first excited state, and you get an interlinear Stark effect regime. So if the interaction are described by an action which is local, Lorentz invariant, and Hermitian, then of course the CPT theorem holds, and T breaking means CP breaking, and we are back to, you know, the initial point where I started about this baryogenesis. So let me give you now a naive estimate of a nucleon EDM that goes back to also to probably this was written up here, but it's probably much older. I think Kolya Nikolaev told me once the Russian kids would learn it in kindergarten. But so, I mean, he told me that. I mean, I was at that time older than 50, so okay. Okay, long time to be in kindergarten. Good. Yeah, you start out with a CP and P conserving magnetic moment, or moment at all, of a nucleon. And that's, of course, given by the nuclear magneton. E over 2, twice the mass of a proton, that's basically in units 10 to minus 14 electron centimeters. That's your starting point. With that, you have to compare everything. Now, you need to have a non-zero EDM, you need CP violation. CP violation means also you need P violation. The price you pay is a factor 10 to minus 7. You get this factor 10 to minus 7 from Fermi's constant. This is, of course, dimension full. So you make a dimension less constant by multiplying with usual hadronic scale. You could take lambda QCD, but that is on the quark level. So you take basically hadronic scale. That's F pi, the order parameter for Kalt symmetry breaking, something that is independent of the quark mass. You can take in any other scale. I mean, basically, we are not working to a factor of 10. So it's 10 to minus 7. And additionally, you have then to pay the price that you have CP violation. And the price you pay is a factor 10 to minus 3. You get it by the ratio of matrix elements of a K long decay into 2 pions versus a matrix element of K short into 2 pions. That's in the order of 10 to minus 3. So altogether, the CP violation will cost you 10 to minus 10 on top of this 10 to minus 14 electron centimeters. So 10 to minus 34 electron centimeters is a constraint on EDM from the known physics except other than EDM measurements. So if an EDM measurement would give you for the neutron something bigger than that, you have really severe problems. So, yeah?
I have a simple question. Why do you consider parity violation separately? Is it like coupling to the...
No, I put it together here, the CP violation on totally. Here you have already parity, both processes violate parity. So I have to put it on top.
So your factor for parity violation looks like coupling to the...
So the whole thing costs you 10 to the minus 10. And I've split it up in parity violation and the rest.
So this is Ratzi's
CP violation.
This is Ratzi's 1957 argument.
Yeah, yeah.
Except he didn't think about CP. He was just interested in parity.
Definitely, yeah. It's much older. Yeah. Good. So it's 10 to the minus 24 electron centimeters. Remember the bound from the EDM measurements for a neutron is 10 to the minus 26. So you already cut. Right? I mean, this is what you know from other physics. So EDMs give you already a reduction by a factor 100 against what you know from other physics. Already 10 years ago. So now let's go to the standard model. In the standard model, without a theta term, so that means CKM mechanism at work, you need another factor GF, F pi square, 10 to the minus 7. Because in the standard model, you know that the CP violation is linked to a flavor change. You need to involve all three generations. So if only once W exchange or something like this, you have to add another one to get back. And that costs you another factor 10 to the minus 7. So the nature scale where you expect the standard model to appear for the neutron is 10 to the minus 31 electron centimeters. So therefore, for students, the empirical window for searches would be that. If we know already we have from the measurements from EDM a stronger bound, this upper number is reduced by a factor 100. But basically, this is something nice you can tell the students, I mean, how to get to these numbers without doing involved calculations. So here is a table that I borrowed from Kolya about the chronology of the upper bounds of the neutron EDM starting from Ramsey in 1957. You know, here this is probably the last measurement by Baker. Baker et al. There's another Russian data out here, which is slightly higher. But it's compatible. I mean, it's not on this plot. And, you know, the standard model predictions are 5 to 6 orders out of this reach. So Ulf likes to have this table. I mean, here it's basically the same stuff as the Collier's one. Here you see the standard model. You see the future planned experiments with ultra. Basically, how you get down here is you have to improve your sources of neutrons. I mean, basically, this is here still Grenoble, and this is the end of the story there. I mean, and here you have to go to better neutron sources. Here you also see the table for a theta parameter. I will discuss it in a moment. I mean, this will be the range of a theta parameter that you would have to test. Okay, So three motivations for EDM searches. Why are EDMs interesting? This meta-anti-meta asymmetry requires CP violation in the standard model. EDMs are an excellent probe for extra-CP violations beyond what you have in the standard model, at least the standard model without theta term. A search for new physics, which is virtually background-free, you have seen the window. And many new physics models predict large EDMs because they involve large phases. So from both things, you have the window, but you have also opportunity. Good. Here still, I mean, I probably can be quite brief on this. This is what you have now from neutral particles, basically all the measurements that you have involve complete neutral systems in the moment, except the EDM for the muon. So this is basically the bound, I mean, here written not as bound, but as a measurement result that is compatible with zero, of Baik et al. And proposed it's to improve it by two orders of magnitude. This is the current bound 2016 by the Washington Group, University of Washington Group, for mercury. And as mentioned, using the theory input, it relates to these two numbers. There are ongoing experiments, as you, on other diamagnetic atoms, xenon, radium, radon may be a possibility. And there are the electron EDM inferred from paramagnetic atoms or nowadays non-degenerate molecules. And the current best bound is from polar forum monoxide from the ACME group in Harvard. And the idea is, of course, I mean, for these neutral systems, it's simple. You have a rather weak magnetic field that you, defines a spin precession. You can measure very nicely frequencies for a spin precession. And when you switch, in theory, the electric field around, one orientation, opposite orientation, and since you measure frequencies, you can you go to a point where you are very sensitive to frequencies change. So not the, the maximum now of the oscillation, but of course close to the zero transfer of the oscillation. And when a shift, you would be very sensitive against the shift. And that's basically the measurement principle. For charged particles, you can't do that, because if you put a charged particle somewhere in a bottle or something like this, you put an electric field, it's gone. So the idea is, of course, to treat the charged particle as a satellite, right? I mean, you know, a satellite moving around the Earth, it moves with a huge velocity, but well, I mean, basically it's a free fall. And the same as here, the charged particle has a free fall in the applied field. And then you can again try to measure its dipole moment by, you know, having a radioelectric field hooked to the spin of a charged particle that is pointing along the beam direction, and then you get from the dipole moment up movement or down movement depending on the sign of the spin, and that you can measure in principle. I mean, this is, of course, a cartoon. I mean, you know, Jörg will come, know that. I mean, reality looks much different, I mean, from this cartoon. But it's, this is the idea. And you have, for the only limit direct measurement for a charged particle is done for a muon as a byproduct of a G minus 2 measurements. And this is rather weak, 10 to minus 19 electron centimeters. Remember, okay, for a muon, the standard Mollin number would be 10 to minus 35 electron centimeters. The muon has slightly heavier mass than the electrons, so from 10 to minus 38 electron centimeters, you go up to 10 to minus 35 electron centimeters. So you're very far away from its standard model bound. So the sensitivity of storage rings, you have a number 10 to minus 39 electron centimeters, but there are huge systematic errors. It's just the statistics that you could might have in 1 year of running. And nobody knows how big these systematic errors is. Therefore, there will be a precursor experiment done in Jülich with protons or neutrons or both. And the expected range is probably at the lower bound, 10 to minus 20 electron centimeters, but who knows? I mean, one has to be optimistic. Good.
So the alternative to this is to use a trap. And, you know, there have been articles sketching out what could be done there, too.
Well, for charged particles?
Charged particles, yes.
But then you, how do you, break, you have already broken the symmetry?
I mean, it's nothing more than a cyclotron.
This is a trap.
It's a huge trap.
Yeah. And it's a really interesting question of which is better in terms of sensitivity, but there's a big difference in cost.
Actually, Derek Carnell is working with Josh.
But it
just applies oscillation. So particle cannot escape within the oscillation time.
That is probably a possibility, yeah. But that's all doable for molecules, right? I mean, But for protons, it's probably pretty hard. So here's a roadmap for EDM measurements to EDM sources. The view here presented is the experimentalist point of view. The theorist point of view is just the opposite. So let's do it. Start as a theorist. You have any fundamental theory that is your pet theory, right? And you know this pet theory of the QCD scale will feed into certain operators, a quark electric dipole moment, a quark chromo EDM, a gluon chromo EDM, four quark operators, lepton quark operators, lepton EDMs. So that depends on the theory what you have. Some will not feed in here. The theta term will only feed up here. The theta term will go directly, actually. Other terms, leptogenesis might feed into this part. Good. Then you have your QCD layer that you have to understand. That means lattice QCD later in practice. Then you have your nuclear theory layer, and there it's already difficult with lattice QCD. So at least at that stage, you might need something more. For light nuclei, Kyle EFT, for heavy nuclei, many body theory. And then for certain quantities, you have even atomic theory as another layer. That is basically for the atoms, diamagnetic paramagnetic molecules. And only the lepton EDM goes directly through here. Unfortunately, we have only one quantity. Measured not. We have not even a number for the electron directly. And for the muon, this is rather a big number. So now let's turn it around and discuss what an experimentalist can do. He can, of course, do as done for the neutron direct measurements. Gets this number, this bound. He can try to do proton. There's no bound, direct bound yet. He can look at light nuclei. Of course, light nuclei are simple systems, and are simply to describe a theory. You can go to diamagnetic atoms. That means the spin is carried by the nucleus, not by the electron cloud. These are these systems, and you get this number, and you can use in theory to get these two numbers up here. But you have you go already through one layer and another layer, right? I mean, you can go to paramagnetic atoms, then you have the atomic theory. You get a number like that, or a number like that, and you get and can deduce the electron EDM. Also, you need the atomic theory, or also part of nuclear theory. Yeah, or you try to do something for the leptons directly.
Can you give some feeling for which experiments are the most promising?
Depending on what? Depending on the detection potential that you see in EDM, I would bet here. I mean, I would bet my money here. I mean, that's probably where the most progress can be done.
But they could reach the standard model or close to the standard model.
The standard model the standard model. You expect something before, right? But I would bet here because these experiments are simple to done. As mentioned, you might use traps, things like this, small tabletop experiments. But who knows? I mean, versus these here need reactors or spallation sources. These need accelerators. So this is detection problem. But you get then one number, and then when you have to interpret it. And when when this hits you, right? I mean, that you have to go all through all these layers, and you might not know what to do with that number. So in order to know what you have to do with that number, especially it's in the hadron sector, then basically these systems will be the simplest one, because here you have at least lattice QCD and Kyle EFT at your disposal to disentangle things. Versus here, it will be complicated. Good.
Something else we need for theory is the nucleon-nucleon CP violating force. Because sort of generically in the nuclei, that's actually the dominant source of the CP violation.
Yeah, absolutely. Therefore, I'm saying it will be much more complicated here.
In some ways, when you interpret the Mercury experiment in terms of a neutron-proton EVM, it sort of underestimates it.
It's a bound. It's a bound that you get. I mean, you assume that the bound is there. But I mean, if you would have a measurement, that it would be a completely different story.
If
you would have a measurement, a non-zero number, and then you would like to interpret what from which parts is coming, then as we will see, it's in a moment difficult.
But if you wanted to just get a limit, say, on the theta parameter, then it's better instead of trying to deduce what the neutron EVM contribution to Mercury is, to figure out what the nuclear force is, because that's where the sensitivity to the theta parameter would show up.
Yeah, but the errors in the moment are 100% to 200%, so you cannot make any statement on this side. Okay, and I will say also at the end, I might say something about it, transparency I will show. I mean, I don't know how far I will get in my talk.
So I'm not talking about the accuracy, it's just that the sensitivity to CP violation does not exist in the individual nuclei EVMs.
But in order to disentangle things, I think at least from a theory point of view, this would be simplest or that one, I mean, if you are lucky. All the other ones need several layers, and especially the diagrammatic, you have to know your nuclear theory pretty well. So how would you do the calculation? Of course, you start with a form factor. This is for simple spin 1/2 particle, you have, I mean, your normal Dirac form factor, your Pauli form factor, the Annapolis form factor that vanishes at Q equals 0. And here you have your PNT breaking electric dipole form factor. And the EDM is, of course, linked to the Q square equals 0 limit of this form factor. That's for spin 1/2 fermions. For nucleus, if you do the calculation for light nucleus, you do the calculation. It simplifies. You can do it, of course, in any frame, but it simplifies if you do it in a bright frame. Then the EDM is just readable, again, as a form factor. Here you have a free momentum appearing. So you split off, and then the rest is the EDM. You have only to put in the correct mass in the denominator. So CP violation with standard model can be short, because that's what was for students. So three generations, I mean, in a standard model, most of a standard model is actually CP invariant. The only part in the standard model that breaks CP invariance is the charge V current interaction that involves the CKM matrix and the theta term. Good. So here I can be short. At one loop, old hat, I mean, you do not get anything from a standard model, because what you gain here at this vertex, where W is split off, is coming back at that part of the vertex. So two loops, I think that's not a simple argument. You have to involve in the order of 9 diagrams that cancel each other. For the quark EDM and quark chromo EDM, you don't get a contribution. However, you get a fake two-loop contribution from a long-distance pion exchange, and here a penguin at this vertex. This is the calculations are in the order of 10 to minus 32 electron centimeters, and three loops give you also some number. Remember, 10 to minus 31 electron centimeter, I estimated with this very naive argument for students, so it doesn't work that badly. And for the electron, you basically put this quark line to a loop, and you put an electron line into this W propagator, and so we have one more loop, two more coupling constants, and therefore it's 10 to minus 38. Good. So that was the one source in the standard model. The other source is, of course, a QCD feeder term. You have a topological non-trivial structure in QCD. You need instantons because the vacuum would be not unique. If you don't do that, introduce a feeder vacuum, you would violate the cluster decomposition theorem at many things, right? I mean, so we know that in the QCD vacuum, you need a theta parameter. And therefore, you have this term. And this term, of course, breaks. I mean, either you write it as E dot B, when you know that electric field and magnetic field transforms differently under B and T. Or you see it here from this total antisymmetric tensor. It was one time index and free spatial index, and so it also has this property. So the trick is, I mean, this term you can rotate out with the help of, UA1 rotation into the quark mass matrix and combine it with the terms that come from the phases of the mass determinant to a quantity that's called theta bar. Theta is not the measure of the quantity. Theta bar is, and it's a parameter of QCD, as the quark masses are parameters of QCD. Quark masses have a given scale. It's another parameter. So, and that you should take seriously. And you know where the CP violating phase and the CKM matrix is of order one. So naively, you would expect this parameter to be of order one. So let's estimate now, make naive dimensional analysis. You see here's the quark mass, actually the reduced quark mass appearing. So if a reduced quark mass would go to zero, you would have the anomaly, and you could completely cancel away the theta term in this way. However, if so here you have your old hat, the 10 to minus 14 electron centimeter of the magnetic moment. Here you have your quark mass divided by the next scale. If you work in two flavors, the next scale would be the strange quark mass. If you work in three flavors, the next scale would be lambda QCD. So basically, whatever you put in, you get another factor 10 to the minus 2 to 10 to the minus 3. So we are in a scale theta bar times 10 to the minus 60 electron centimeters. So naively, you would expect from theta term a contribution of this order. Now you compare again to Baker et al. To the neutron EDM experiment, and you see this theta bar has to be smaller than 10 to the minus 10, and this is of course the strong CP problem. So for the students, I would now discuss the strong CP problem, but I know that you know that, and so I will skip that if you agree. So 10 to the minus 10 to the window for theta is therefore this window, right? I mean, that you have, because your 10 to minus 31 would be the standard model, the CKM mechanism of a standard model would give you a contribution for a neutron EDM. So for the theta part in the standard model, you have this window. However, it will not, this theta term will not explain the matter surplus if you would measure such a theta term. It would be fine, it would be nice. It would constrain another parameter of QCD that you would not know before, but it would not explain baryogenesis because the scales do not match up. You would expect, you know, this. Remember the free Sakharov conditions, you need, out of equilibrium transition, and that you probably have to have there. And this transition, the theta term is active at this scale, so I mean, doesn't match. Good. So we need new physics, probably, I mean, to explain baryogenesis or something else. I mean, not the theta term would be not enough.
So from the point of view of cosmology, baryogenesis, how large does the EDM have to be for that to?
This is not direct. The standard model values are too small.
Yeah. But you reached a goes.
Yeah, it could be the lepton sector, everything happening. So, I mean, when you have 10 to minus 48, so nobody knows. It's not a direct thing.
It's more than dependent. So yeah. There are models in which we can hook up strong first-order phase transition with CP violation, and then you end up predicting a range, which includes the 10 to minus 27, 10 to minus, I mean, within reach of next generation. Of course, those prediction come with two kind of error bars, one associated with because Molly, you know, we have to do this evaluation transport at, in the universe. So there's a fuzziness in those numbers. But yes, there are models that predict EVMs in the 10 to minus 28 centimeter.
Okay, so new physics we probably need, and you know, I will be very brief here because I would repeat what Vincenzo was already talking before. You would start with new physics scale somewhere way above the electroweak scale, and then you will integrate out the new physics to get to the standard model. You have a standard model running. You integrate out the heavy standard model particles and run down to the QCD scale. And where you have here, this is a regime where you would expect then that lattice QCD can be applied. And in the end, you have EDM measurements just at the, you know, at the atomic scale or at a very small scale. And in order to to link from this non-perturbative part here to the experiment, you need something like lattice QCD or Kyle EFT. I mean, something that is reliable that gives you uncertainties. Because in this game, as you might have realized by now, or probably have realized before, the part is not the central value. The part is everything is in the uncertainties in the experiment and also in theory. So if you do not have the uncertainties under control, forget it. Okay, here, this idea, I will skip it because you have seen it. There's no dimension 5 operator because this would be only the Mariana master. So you have the idea would be to why you use EFT at the upper scale to go from the new particle, new physics scale down to the standard model scale is you have here, for instance, in SUSY, this free gluon vertex with a CP violating vertex here between the gluinos and quarkinos and the quark. And if you run it down, you see you induce a kind of Weinberg term. So this is here the table. At a higher upscale, slightly above the electroweak or close to the electroweak breaking, you have here. While you have your Higgs, you're coupling a photon to a quark line with a Higgs. This will, if you integrate out the Higgs, will become the quark EDM. Here you have a gluon interacting with a quark line Higgs. This will be the quark color EDM, etc. Of course, they mix. I mean, this is not one-to-one. You get mixing already at that level. Here you have an interesting part because you have here coupling of a W boson with two Higgses, actually a mixture of a left-handed to right-handed W boson, and two Higgses and to the right-handed quarks. This will go down to a special type of four quark left-right term, but it's very sensitive. Here you have a Weinberg term of that mixes with the other terms and standard four quark terms. And at this scale, again, you feed into all this and not, you know, this is the nucleon, the quark line is replaced by the nucleon, but you have to be careful. I mean, all these terms will feed into here. So in total, even if you only take the first generation into account, you have, you know, theta term, there's a dimension 4 term. You have two quark EDMs because you have isospin conserving, isospin violating part. Two quark color EDMs, isospin conserving, isospin violating. One left-right term, one Weinberg term, and even two other four quark terms left over. Then you have, at that level, first generation, three semi-leptonic terms and one leptonic term. And the caveat is, of course, you could, of course, at least think about maybe you should need the second generation. Good. So here's once more this picture, you have seen it. So here are these terms explained before that appear in this picture. Good. So now you have to go from this quarkish machine language to the human hadronic language, right? I mean, we need some free CPO to do the job for us. It's golden, so why not goldstone? Yeah, basically, this free CPO as far as our symmetries, especially the Kahle symmetry, and our isospin symmetries that do the job for us. And you can combine this in an efficient way in Kahle perturbation theory. If you involve more than two nucleons, it's Kahle effective theory, or any variant of that. Good. And here you have, I mean, these were the hadronic operators. You have here a CP violating isospin conserving coupling of pions to nucleon. Violating isospin violating coupling of a pi zero to a nucleon. You know, the quark, photon coupling to a nucleon, again, isospin conserving, isospin violating. And what is forgotten at some time, you have a free pion CP violating term. And now you can look at a table. I mean, maybe because time has already short, so I will be brief on this. This tells you which terms are most prominent for which operator. Once the theta term, why is this part predominant and this suppressed? The reason is the theta term is, of course, isospin neutral, right? I mean, it doesn't, it comes from the gluon physics after all, or from a determinant of a mass matrix. So both are isospin neutral. So therefore, this is the leading term. This is suppressed. The photon is suppressed because you have to get rid of a photon in a photon loop to start with. This is also suppressed. For the quark EDM, it's just the opposite. The quark EDM is, you have a direct photon coupling to a quark line, so that will be the leading term. And the other ones are subleading. For a quark Kahle EDM, basically that and that, you have isospin allowed, isospin breaking. That depends now on the model which one is dominating, but I mean, without knowing anything, you assume democracy and both are of the same size. All the other ones are suppressed. For the left-right model, this left-right model breaks from the very start for you, that I've forgotten to mention. So let me mention it now and show it to you here. You see, you break isospin by the very beginning. You break isospin at the fundamental level. And that is, of course, very important because breaking isospin at the fundamental level means that this part is strong, this part is weak, or the other parts are weak. Actually, this part here, you will see, we can later on link this number here for this model directly to here. So this coefficient will play the role of the theta term in, for a theta term, you can express everything in terms of a theta term, G0, G1, etc. So you can do similar things for the left-right model. It's all simpler than all the other models in this respect. This would be the Weinberg term and the four-quark term. First of all, you wonder why these terms are suppressed. Well, the Weinberg term and four-quark term are Kahle symmetric to start with. We have a Goldstone boson comes. You have a coupling here of a pion directly to a nucleon. And you have to, of course, respect the Goldstone theorem. This coupling should vanish as vanishing momenta or quark masses. So you punish these two couplings by m pi square. That means they are suppressed. So, but you cannot, I mean, nobody will be able to discriminate these terms unless you have some other input, like maybe from lattice or whatever. But they completely behave in the same way, and they are the most difficult to detect. Well, in reality, of course, you would have, for a theta term, you might have one term, but for the other terms, there would be mixtures. For the left-right scenario, you might have also one term. But for Zuzi or, two Higgs models or things like this, you will have this term, that term, that term, and maybe even four quark terms. And then you are free to disentangle that. Good. This is, again, this picture, so you know what to do. Okay, now let's first start with the simplest dimension four operator theta term. Single nucleon EDM. This calculation is controlled. This was done already in for how much is it? 40 years ago? Well, at least 45 years ago, I suppose. Huh? No, 35 years ago. By Kruf and Ivecchia. So you have a relationship with vertex. You can do this loop. This loop is, of course, divergent. You normalize it, adjust it with scale, whether you take the nucleon mass, the Rho mass, another strange quark mass is at your disposal. It's in the log, so it's a small shift. It's in a way controlled, the loop part. What is not controlled, the loop part is divergent, as mentioned. So you need counterterms. There are counterterms. In effect, there are two counterterms, one for the neutron, one for a proton. This holds even for SU3, as shown by Ulf and Fengkun Guo. So you have two counterterms because, you know, the proton carries charge, so it is the neutron none. I mean, so we expect two counterterms at least. And they are. And of course, not naively, these counterterms are in the order of the loop term. And so basically, Kyle perturbation theory cannot say, well, you can give naive dimension arguments, but that gives you only the magnitude, an estimate for magnitude, but not for the sign. So the sign could be anything. And there you are. I mean, basically, that's the end of KFT at this point. Well, for theta term, you can get an expression that was basically, this is a modern expression. I mean, Kruffer had a similar expression. You can get, you can express the G0 theta, this coefficient, in terms of the theta bar, the parameter, times the strong difference between neutron and proton masses. So if you get to this number, and epsilon, epsilon involves, the ratio of the quark masses. Both you get from lattice QCD nowadays. And you get rather strict bounds, so you get here nice number, I mean, nice relationship between theta bar and this parameter to this accuracy.
Yeah, what was wrong with the original paper? Who put this 0.7 of theta? There was a number in this paper.
But we have, you know, this number was not known very nicely. If you go back, this number at that time, the epsilon, you know, the quark masses went down in lattice QCD, also the ratio changed.
But they were also using octet masses.
They were used octet masses also, yeah.
I mean, nothing was wrong conceptually.
No, but the number is, of course, in, if you would put their number with arrow bars, it would be probably still overlapping.
It was 0.7, it was so much bigger.
No, no, 0.7, more. It was never 0.7, it was 0.2 something, or must have been. 0.7 is definitely wrong. Good. Okay. And you know the contribution of then if you plug this number into here, you get this number for the isovector loop, basically, of this order. Remember this order, it's 2 times 10 to minus 16 electron centimeters times theta bar. So now you can, you know, you have two of these two unknown coefficients, what you do about them. And the answer is you have no other way than the lattice. You have a question you have to ask the lattice, and the lattice should try to give you an answer. This is here, once more, of a chi PT point. Well, it's not quite true. This is the one loop part of a chi PT point. Right? I mean, as mentioned, there were coupling constants, the counter terms that might change the sign even of this term. What you remember for the theta term is this part will vanish if a quark mass goes to zero. That means if a prime mass goes to zero. We have a strict bound that the EDM prediction from a theta term should go to zero for vanishing prion mass. And this is here, and these are the quark measurement, the lattice measurements, sorry, of basically Igo Shintani and other groups. I mean, you were also involved, I think, at an early stage. And this is, was just to see, I mean, the situation at that time looked Well, depends on whom you ask. I mean, I was worried, but you might know lattice guys are not worried about that. But at least it looks, yeah.
It looks flat too.
Yeah, okay, I mean, good. And systematic errors are probably, I think, underestimated. Ulf and Arkan and Feng Kong Guo use this information. Remember, we had two counterterms to fit the counterterm with the X information that this number has to vanish here, right? And this was very important. And that we could extrapolate to these high masses. I think this is 330 MeV pion, and this is 420 MeV pion. So it's already in the verge where you would believe things. Okay. So we got these numbers then for the neutron and for the proton, and we did a new work with, you know, the shear holes using different method, and we got from that method this number that is compatible with that. So here is now an update from Aigo Shintani from this year, and where we included also a lower pion mass. And now you see probably to wait. I mean, this was the old situation, but the new point is this. Either the errors are too small or, you know, I mean, or something is going on or whatever. So the situation is there. This is probably what we have now, the status. We have to wait. It will improve eventually. I suppose that that's true in this lattice scale, you know, what things will improve eventually, and we have to wait. Of course, I mean, we should mention that, don't mention light nuclei if you have already a problem with a neutron. I mean, how on Earth you will be able to go to the light nucleon. So then we have now, fortunately, Victor and Kriplovich and Sushkov have come up with an idea that this vertex here appears also nuclei, and it appears a nuclei at leading order because, you know, where this is here, here's in a loop hidden. Here it appears in a tree-level part. Of course, you have, effectively, you have loops in a wave function, but, I mean, that's a different story. So here it's tree level, and the corresponding counterterm would be then suppressed if you would form a loop. So you are not affected by unknown counterterms to leading order. So that is a nice thing to use. So here once more we have now our EDM for the deuteron at leading order, the CP violating pion exchange parts. Since we do not know better, what we do now is we have two subtraction constants. Why not put the proton EDM and the neutron EDM as the subtraction constants and lump it there, and that's it. These are these two terms. Then we have a free pion term, that's overtime there. We should not forget that one. Then we have the isospin conserving pion nucleon interaction and the isospin violating. And then we have four nucleon interactions. Here are only the isospin conserving ones. The isospin violating ones are there, of course, here's a dot dot where you have infinitely many terms, but all of them are chirally suppressed. So now the deuteron fortunately acts as an isospin filter. You know, you have a free S1 state for the deuteron, and of course, isospin zero. The photon, whatever it doesn't change the spin. If you want to have an EDM, you can either have here a singlet P1 or triplet P1 state in the middle, and you have a Pauli principle. So in order that the Pauli principle works, the singlet P1 is out. So you have to go to the triplet P1 because, you know, you cannot from here to here you cannot change the spin. The photon doesn't do it. So you have here an isospin violating vertex. The isospin allowed vertices here, here, here are all forbidden. And you have to go to lower order to get contribution. So therefore, life is simple for the deuteron. You have, of course, this counterterm, the neutron EDM, the proton EDM, the G1. And as mentioned, there's this three prime part, and this three prime part plays a role. And that will be also important for atoms and nuclei. You have a coupling of a three pion that goes here with this vertex. And this part is huge unless this coefficient is small. If you plug in numbers later on, you will see that you get a 50% correction to G1 in the opposite way. And this part is momentum dependent because it was a finite loop. This loop is finite, has no counter term. So that one will, nobody has put that into any nuclear calculation. And you know, for heavy nuclei, the momenta are more important. So all bets are off what this term will do for you for the G1. It's of course also not in any QCD sum rule or whatever. I mean, nobody has, if I use QCD sum rules to estimate G1, I mean, okay, I will not say more.
Can you explain why this term is huge here based on some chiral?
It's huge. It gets actually, if you do it naively, you would get a factor 15 less. You get a factor pi because, you know, this the folklore is that we triple this triangle terms get a factor pi. And here all isospins add up coherently, and you get a factor 5.
So can you take that vertex and somehow push it to a point?
For these light systems, it's still okay. But we don't know what is true for the heavy systems. Because
I just kind of wondered, what's the structure of that? If you do that, what does that coupling look like, that effective coupling?
It looks like a G1. It's isospin breaking. So therefore, we wrote delta F G1. It adds coherently to G1.
So there's some sort of effective.
Yeah, G1. It's effective G1, but this for the light systems, you could say it's just. You would not make a big error if you really treat this as an effective G1. For the heavy systems, we don't know because there's a momentum dependence, linear momentum dependence.
But in a heavier system, form factor, there's more and more emphasis on long-range physics, and so I would think it would actually push the momentum scale lower, not higher.
No, the momentum dependence is going, at least for what we go for a form factor, is, the higher momentum, the more you add.
Probably not the way to think about it. It's a polarization. Yeah. And so what you want to do is you want to reach as many nucleons as you can.
Yeah.
So there's a geometric effect in these heavy nuclei that pushes the effective momentum of an interaction to lower values, not higher values. Yeah.
Well, okay. At least this one will be strong. So, and here you have the numbers, and you can compare. These are done in the old-fashioned chiral perturbation theory that was before 2000. When was it, the deadline? 2014? Evgeny, when you did change things? 2014, where we used still, these Lippmann-Schwinger cutoffs and spectral function cutoffs, a la Evgeny, had five variants of that. Did the calculation, used the central value and the spread, and we determined the errors here. And you can come compare to calculations using West potential, the CD Bonn, and you get basically these numbers. Actually, here, this is a point that everybody did it wrong, except these two, this gentleman and this lady. It's of course trivial if you think about it, but nobody was thinking about it. You have a deuteron, spin 1, and of course, the particle can be, the spin of the proton, neutron, can be in the direction of a spin 1 particle or opposite for the D state. Not for the S state, but for the D state. And therefore, you get a reduction. This is model dependent, this quantity. That, of course, gives you something, raises a flag you have to think about. There's a model dependence, so the whole result should be, of course, not model dependent. So there should be, of course, model dependence in other quantities, like, for instance, in short-range terms that are left out here, maybe also in these coefficients. So.
So then you're expressing everything in terms of Vn and dp are the full neutron and proton?
Yeah,
the counterpart.
For full. Yeah.
So they implicitly also
have. They have many things other, but this is a way, just to make the calculation simple, because In the end, you can, of course, subtract this total number weighted by this number from the final result, and then you have something that is directly calculable in theory. Here I should now go do it once. I mean, this is your poor man's way to do Prezi. You can also make, nonlinear talk. And you end up here. I mean, this is basically Yevgeny's scheme. You calculate to leading order, next to leading order, next to next to leading order, and 3LO and 4LO using these cutoffs here that are tabulated for the R cutoffs or R, cutoffs in momentum and configuration space. You have momentum cutoffs. The external free momentum change is, of course, small, but the parent mass is what it is. So you get then this factor, and you can now see your development. This is, of course, I should warn you, this plot means this is the contribution to the G1 matrix element. Here, it doesn't mean that we work at a scale 0.88 Fermi, but it means we have split up. This is the result for 0.8 Fermi, leading order, next to leading order, next to leading order, and 3LO and 4LO, and here it's 4.9, and so on. And of course, you see there's a, you would expect naively that you get a straight line, while you get not quite a straight line. That means you have also probably model dependence in here. But if you take into the N3LO results into account, you at least get an improvement from that number that was the number before to this number that is basically one order of magnitude better.
Yeah, so basically I would interpret that, it's small as a measure of the impact of the short range.
Yeah. At least I should show you one comparison where you don't have a slope, namely for binding energy, what Yevgeny showed, where you get a extremely nice number. So let me do Prezi and go back. So this was for the deuteron. For the helium, unfortunately, we don't have the new results. We have only the old results. For the helium, you don't have the isospin filter. So we have also the isospin conserving part. This is the leading part for a theta term. For the quark color EDM, it would be leading. The G1 would be for the quark color EDM, also the leading term, but for the theta term, next to leading, etc. And here you see the numbers. Here again, to normal potentials, here the units. We only think that, the numbers are the numbers. I mean, they basically agree, they are quite stable. What you should notice is, however, is for the for short range interactions, this is the four nucleon terms. And there you have quite a bit of model dependence in the numbers. So AB18 is more than one order of magnitude less than all the other ones. And or even born. The reason is, for instance, it's very dependent on the short-range physics of these phenomenological potentials. If you would weaken them by introducing a finite range on top of that, what we have, so we'll introduce some in the interaction, would be finite boson that does the punishes momenta that are bigger than the finiteness of a boson, then you would enhance these numbers. And for the AB18, you have also a strong repulsion built in.
But again, those are air coefficients, right?
So they depend, where they scale also. But still, but I mean, where they scale, I mean, the scaling is probably better the stableness is better than this difference, right? These numbers are definitely compatible with non-zero.
I forgot what C1 and C2 are.
I'm sorry for that. These are these CP violating four nucleon terms. Isospin conserving. We have also isospin violating, but they are one order of magnitude down, or two orders of magnitude down, sorry. But they play a role for the left-right symmetric terms. So, okay, now last 5 minutes. Let me discriminate between three scenarios at one GV scale. That's you all the time. I mean, whatever you do, whatever you people tell you, you should test first the theta term because of the dimension four operator, even if the Petri-Quinn mechanism is working and things like this. That is the one you have to exclude or to verify. So the next model we talk about is the left-right symmetric model, because it has a very very striking signature. It has isospin breaking at the fundamental level. So that will show up, and this will be very strong. And then, for instance, there's a third alternative, aligned to Higgs doubled model. And the upshot of this is you hardly can tell anything about that. I mean, you have to make more concrete. You have to have lattice input. Here's once more, these are the models, and it matches on the hadronic level to this Lagrangian involving dn, dp, this free pion coupling, this isospin conserving, isospin violating pi nucleon coupling, and these four nucleon couplings, plus for the left right, we will have also isospin breaking versions of that one. So now you start out. Here are the pictures, right? I mean, if you like diagrams, this is what they correspond to. Good, this is here the free pion, for instance, and this is here the four nucleon. So let's start a testing strategy. Measurement of the helium and neutron EDMs. Then you, with two measurements, you can make the subtraction, and you have on the theory side this relationship. So with that, only with measurements, you don't even need lattice input, you can get a prediction for theta, two measurements. So extract theta, and now you can test it with another measurement, maybe with a deuteron EDM, model with arrows here. Or vice versa, you take with deuteron EDM and neutron EDM and try it.
Is there enough for tritium?
Tritium is nobody will, I mean, I have done it because we can do the calculation.
There is a result, yeah?
No, there's no. We have a number for the tritium.
Yeah,
theoretical result, of course.
It's the same as for...
No, it's tritium, unfortunately, would be the better particle, because the G0 part and G1 part add up coherently. And for the helium-free, they add up destructively. So therefore, this number is rather small here. I mean, you would have expected much bigger number. But we are unfortunate, right? I mean, the wrong nucleus has, I mean, the one that might be measured or could be measured simply, well, simply, that would not get the greens running, I mean, that you would be or measured in places other than... in no other places than Los Alamos, somewhere in Russia, or maybe in China somewhere, or in Pakistan. back to physics. So, I mean, you have this, and you can predict, the pattern would be that the EDM for the nuclear part, I'm talking about the nuclear part where you subtracted these numbers, for a deuteron is opposite to the free helium. Equal and opposite. That would be a striking pattern. And you can deduce it from basically this ratio of G1 to G0 theta that you can get from these numbers. It's all empirical input.
Where does this 0.94 come from? Because it has no error.
Where's the 0.94?
Well, you're saying
this has a very small error. This is once more. Remember, I talked about that the deuteron, the contribution of a single nucleon EDMs to the deuteron is not 1 plus 1,
okay,
but 0.9.
But it has a small error compared to.
And for the free helium, basically the neutron is the only important single nucleon because the protons pair up to spin 0. To leading order, so it's small, so you can just do this. For deuteron, you need information of a neutron proton to be. Okay, so this basically is the theta term would be the first test. This would be another test, of course. Lattice QCD could also give a test. I mean, for instance, if you do a measurement for a neutron, you use lattice QCD to get the theta term. You made a prediction for a proton. So you have here an orthogonal test. So basically, with the help of these tests, you can definitely say, exclude the theta term scenario or consider it further, right? I mean, that is the first thing you should all the time consider, because dimension four operator. So now let's go to the left-right symmetric model. So where you would measure, the deuteron, For the left-right symmetric model, basically the contributions of, you know, for the neutron EDM, this was the loop effect came with an isospin conserving pion loop. But this is small in this scenario because isospin conserving is extremely small against isospin violating part. And the isospin violating loop is small. So therefore, the nucleon parts, this scenario you can forget to leading order. And you are completely sensitive to the nuclear parts. And these nuclear parts are given here. Maybe I should already flash everything that you don't. Ah, I forgot to give a star. This star is the arrow, the uncertainty that you get from the contact terms. And these are unavoidable. If you don't have a lattice calculation that tells you how the coefficient of the contact terms look like, you basically have to live with this uncertainty. And this uncertainty also applied here. You know, for the deuteron, you don't have this uncertainty, but for helium, it's basically most of this uncertainty is coming from these contact terms. That will be, of course, also the case in heavy nuclei, because you have no way to exclude these terms. Here, of course, it's, I must say, this is for the free helium. For the triton, this uncertainty would be of the same magnitude, but this number would be factor twice bigger. So one, it's at least 10%. Good, and here for the left-right scenario, you would have the same isospin breaking would be working for the free helium. You would get a similar number, slightly less, and you would have, again, a similar error. And here the striking scenario would be these numbers should be big, bigger than the nucleon, actually, and all have the same sign. Of course, the triton you might not have, but, I mean, at least deuteron helium, you could clearly distinguish that scenario from the theta term scenario. And the reason is G1, the isospin breaking coefficient, is very much larger than G0. So now the two Higgs doublet model as a candidate. I mean, could have also used SUSY or whatever. There you have to live with, you don't know G1, you don't know delta. So you have to rely on getting this either fitted to experiment. For instance, for deuteron and for free helium, when you can you have the G1, the delta, the G0, you can extract. We have a relationship between the G1 and the delta that you might still get. So you can extract two coefficients, but when you have fixed the two coefficients, you have to look somewhere else to test it, unless you have a prediction for these coefficients, that is lattice. Good. Again, there's an uncertainty from the 2N contact terms. Okay, and you could predict here in the scenario, oh, I forget it, triton, or, I mean, that is, of course, not what you do. So, let me summarize. The deuteron EDM might distinguish between the theta bar scenario and other scenarios, allows the extraction of G1 from the deuteron part, and the prefactor of Dn plus Dp. Okay, this part here is just a 4% probability of a 3D state, model dependent. Free helium or triton, I mean, free helium would be enough to proper distinguish the theta bar scenario from left-right scenarios. That you can do with measurements alone without the help of lattice. But you could, of course, lattice would still help, right? I mean, reduce the number of measurements. This is the reason deuteron helium work as complementary isospin filters for EM. 2N contact terms can never be neglected beyond deuteron. So, and then there have to be, I mean, there will be major source of errors in the end. The aligned to doublet Higgs case where you would need more measurements, I mean, for helium, triton, or any other thing you would need to pin it down, or you need lattice input. Ultimate progress may eventually come from lattice QCD, where you can calculate the coefficients that go into the matrix elements. Then, of course, you are done. I mean, you can calculate the matrix elements in Kyle EFT. You get the coefficients from lattice, then you can do predictions. Pure quark EDM, of course, is simple to identify because then it's just given by basically the sum of the deuteron EDM is just proton plus neutron, model with these small shifts, and the free helium EDM is just a neutron EDM. But dream of a model that just gives you a quark EDM and nothing else. I mean, this is maybe some split Zuzi does it, but I mean, it's probably very fine-tuned. Good. The gluon color EDM and four quark EDM are Keil singlets, and they are extremely difficult to pin down. I mean, they are probably the only help come from lattice. Huh. So here, this was one where to that I should not forget traditional atomic EDMs. Why can't we get all this information that I just discussed, singling out a theta term, discriminant left-right scenarios, and from or calculating the matrix elements from atomic calculations using Mercury EDM that has the best bound. I mean, absolutely, this is the best bound of any measurement. Yeah. The atomic part of the calculation is well under control. I had this, Victor was saying it's probably only 10%. So I think.
There were several calculations.
Yeah, yeah, okay. But, it's in this range. This error is not important. I mean, it means it's under control. Atomic physics is under control to that order. But the nuclear part isn't. 100 to 200% errors. And this is just done the naive way, right? I mean, G0 and G1. Now there comes, there's no power counting for nuclei with so many nucleons. Short range for nucleon contributions were never considered in all this game. The CP violating free pi contribution delta FG1 that contributes, remember, added here for the free helium and deuteron, grows linearly with momentum transfer, so more important for heavier systems. Whatever you do, you have something that is momentum-dependent part to the isospin breaking pi nuclear interaction.
I'm not sure I buy that argument, but I agree it's never been calculated. It's just the nuclei saturate, and so the momentum scale doesn't really change.
Yeah, but you don't know how big it is, and nobody knows.
I agree.
At least that. And the hadronic uncertainties of G0 and G1 in this situation are definitely underestimated. I mean, they're used. Russian sum rule input, we remember it's just U, D, S quarks, and then of, I mean, nobody. For instance, for the G1, you have two contributions if you go to a hadronic world that contribute there, and nobody knows how to disentangle that. So, conclusions. That is the real final conclusion. EDM probes new CPOT physics at similar energy scales as LHC or even higher. The first non-vanishing EDM might be detected in a charge-neutral case, neutrons or di or paramagnetic atoms or molecules or point. You know, I mean, that's maybe the squids or whatever do the job. But okay, then you can claim hooray and get a ticket to Stockholm, but otherwise, I mean, nobody knows yet what is the reason for it, right? I mean, you have one measurement. So basically, measurement of light ion EDMs can play a role. They don't have to, but they can play a role in disentangling the sources of flavor diagonal CP violating, as you have seen. Lattice could, of course, eventually do it also, but when they have to be have nuclei of this with light pions under control in this situation. EDM measurements are characteristically, that I should stress, they are low energy experiments. Right? You have high energy physics, test low energies. Atoms, molecules, solid states, neutrons and protons. So we have to express in the language of hadrons, and the only systematic methods are Keil EFT or lattice. Nothing else. On these EDMs provide independent information to nucleon ones and maybe even larger for the left-right scenario. And as Victor already envisioned in 30 years ago, simpler. Good. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, well, we've had lots of questions already, so let's launch.
Okay, but my very little comment because I think it's going to interrupt you. And just is that a moment of wanting to good or bad? I explain what you're saying. It doesn't produce any systematic effect because actually the effect is like if you have two closed levels of opposite penetrate and more close to one other, the effect is behaves like that. This is intrinsic dipole moment of a molecule, yeah?
Yeah.
So it's it does not matter, it's quadratic star or linear. Even in linear regime, it's still absolute value of energy. So it doesn't produce any problem that molecule has big dipole moment. On the contrary, it gives a huge advantage. Because what actually happens, for example, thorium oxide, interaction with electron-electric dipole moment make dipole moment of molecule directed along electron-electric dipole moment, or angular momentum. So you explore big dipole moment of molecule, which is, of course, many orders of magnitude bigger than electron-electric dipole moment.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, this...
Some kind of CP-violating interaction, including some electration of electron in DM, polarized dipole moment of molecule along its angular momentum. So polar molecule is an advantage because it has very big internal dipole moment.
Yeah. That's true, but if you would make the ease, no contradiction to what I said. If you make E small enough, of course you would see the E square effect.
Yeah, but even if it's big, it doesn't mean.
I mean,
the absolute value of E doesn't.
It depends on the level of here, whatever it's placing.
It's absolute value of energy, so it doesn't produce any systematics. This is important. Yeah, what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, of course.
In your quadratic regime. It doesn't produce any systematics. It gives an advantage because you actually explore this moment. Because your dipole moment of molecule in the stationary state, due to, say, electron EDM, is proportional to dipole moment of a polar molecule. It simply polarized dipole moment.
Yeah, but polar molecule, we have the advantage that, of course, you don't get any problems. The naive EDM is, the naive EDM that you would expect would be zero because the spin axis is perpendicular on it. So
no,
you can only get
normal language of the general perturbation theory. It's kind of trivial. So it's good, not bad, but molecule has polar with electric dipole moment. It doesn't produce any systematics and it actually enhances the effect because what is it actually measure in fact is
if you would have no the point is if you would have no no CP violation, and of course this this dipole moment would be gone.
But you
have a dipole moment for water that was is tabulated, right? But this is not a permanent dipole moment. It's basically something.
No,
like
but
it.
In a stationary state again, it's zero.
Yeah.
Yes, it's
Good.
Okay. Thank you.